Spirit Guide Underground, February 16, 2008.
Warning, access restricted. Enter password. Begin DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Spirit.
Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast. I'm Peter France, and the creator of Spirit Blade Productions. We're bringing you Christian sci-fi and fantasy that's unsterilized, unsafe, and unleashed on your ears and imagination. You can check out what we're doing and grab lots of cool downloads at www.spiritblade.net. I haven't gotten that next part of the commentary out for Spirit Blade yet, but I am working on it, so please bear with me. I'll get that out as quickly as I can. We got some cool movie info and comic books and stuff to talk about this week, and then an interesting chapter, or at least we're going to look at the first part of chapter 12 in the book of Acts. We're taking a little bit more time because I found that there's some interesting stuff that we could kind of temporarily sidetrack off into as we pass through that chapter, so we're going to take a look at that. But first, let's take a look at our updates. We had a little adventure this week. I thought that I had forgotten to record some lines with Mike Tully, who does the voice of Ran. He came out here last summer, and we actually paid to fly him out for a weekend. Actually, it was during the week, but it was like a... I think it was just one night that he was here. I could be wrong, but I think it was just one night. He came at one, like a Tuesday morning, and we recorded all day and into the evening, and then we recorded the next day, and he got on a plane probably about like 5 o'clock the next day. So we had, you know, less than 48 hours to get all of his lines recorded and done. And for a small company like us, you know, it was a big deal to fly an actor out. You know, when he did the first Spirit Blade, he lived here, so it was no big deal. But I really wanted to have him back to do Ran, and so I had him record, fly out to record. And so anyway, I checked and double-checked everything when he recorded. You know, he would, you know, we'd be recording all day, and then he'd, you know, need some rest for his voice and just for his body. He'd be tired, so he'd go take a nap, but I'd stay up and, you know, during his naps and at night when he'd go to bed to listen to all the files that we'd recorded and make sure that I got all the lines that I needed for Ran, because this is my one shot, you know, because I don't know what kind of recording equipment he might have available or might not back at his home in Nebraska. So, but I had a little scare this week because I got to a part in this really pivotal part of this scene for Rand's character that needs the lines that we recorded, and they weren't there, and I was like, oh crap, please tell me that I didn't somehow forget. And I went searching through all these files of Rand's, listening to them, and I thought, oh crap, I'm going to have to try and figure out a creative way to get around this. You know, I'd used a tape player, a tape recorder on our desk, so that when in between recording with the mic, with the, you know, high-end microphone, I could turn that on to record our conversation and our practices for behind-the-scenes featurettes in the future. And I was thinking, boy, I hope that I caught us at least rehearsing it, and then maybe I can use the context of the action sequence, because Rand's getting beat up pretty bad. Maybe I could use the context of the action sequence to say that there's some damage to his voice, and so it's going to sound cruddy or a little bit, and so I could get away with using, like, you know, this tape recorded kind of rehearsal version of the lines. I was really racking my brain thinking about how I was going to get around this. I was thinking of digging up lines that he recorded for the first Spirit Blade and rewriting some dialogue and having another actor that's local that's in the same scene re-record some lines to fit around how, you know, it would be rewritten around the missing lines to convey the same ideas, but using just various tricks. I really thought I was screwed. And then I finally found it. It was in a file that was labeled strangely, and I just started a new recording file right at that spot, and thankfully I did have those lines, and they're so pivotal. It's such a dramatic scene. I look back and I think, oh my gosh, I don't know how I could have done that and kept the same feeling of that scene. It's right. It's one of the major cliffhangers of Dark Ritual. By cliffhanger, I mean cliffhanger in the middle of the story, and we don't come back to see the issue with Ran resolved for several scenes, you know, so it keeps the audience in suspense for a while. So it's a major high point in Dark Ritual, and I was scared. I was scared. But I finally found them. My problem was Tully was the first one to record, and I hadn't in the script divided up the scenes into scene numbers. So when I was labeling his files, I was labeling them inconsistently, sometimes based on page numbers of the script, sometimes based on scene descriptions, as the lost file was, and sometimes based on what I thought the approximate number of the scene would be. So, you know, idiot me, I have all these scenes of Tully's that he recorded for Rand that are labeled completely inconsistently, and so I just have to always search through them and listen to the beginning of each file to figure out which one I need, whereas the others are much more streamlined and consistently labeled and stuff like that. I really just need to go rename all those files, but I figured since I'm halfway through mixing Dark Ritual, it's kind of late at this point, it's not that big of a deal, so I probably won't, but ugh, I should have remembered that. I should have just remembered that I was inconsistent in my labeling, and then I might not have freaked out so quickly, but oh well. So that was the adventure for this week. Let's jump into our main feature, talk about some cool movies and comic books.
Primary feature. Activated.
All right, we've got some cool movie/TV info at the beginning here. E! Online reports that, according to Summer Glau, Cameron, that's the name of the female Terminator on Terminator the Sarah Connor Chronicles, they've named her Cameron, which I think is appropriate. I'm sure that's a nod to James Cameron, director of the first two Terminator films. Cameron may not be about what she says she's about. On Friday, Summer Glau told E! Online, "It's a mystery at this point if Cameron's intentions are what she presents them to be. I don't even really know what's going on with Cameron. I do know that maybe she has a mysterious past, and it's unclear what she ends up being in the future. But at this point, I think that all three of us, as far as what I know from the script, we are all fighting for the same goal, but that may turn out to be sort of a front. Cameron might have come back from the past for a different purpose." I think she means come back from the future, doesn't she? Anyway, I've been enjoying the Sarah Connor Chronicles a lot. It's not a big action fest, so if you're expecting the level of action from the movies, you'll be disappointed. But in terms of if you just like the lore, the concepts of the Terminator franchise, this is a great TV series. I'm still not sold on how Summer Glau is portraying her Terminator character, Cameron. You know, I feel like we're going to go the route of Data a little bit, like a robot learning to feel, you know, and I feel like, crap, we've been there, you know? I mean, it's definitely been done with Data, but it seems like it's been done with other sci-fi stories, too. I mean, with Spock learning emotions, you know, all these kind of robot-type characters with no emotions learning how to feel over the course of time and always in this cute, I don't know what a jack-in-the-box is, oh, this is interesting, giving them these kind of childlike qualities and stuff like that, and, you know, it was funny, and it worked a little bit in Terminator 2 with Arnold Schwarzenegger because of his physique and because he's just already, by nature of the way he is as an actor, he's limited to this steely kind of cold Austrian buff kind of, you know, but with Summer Glau, it's coming across like Data, and she's, I don't want her to become likable, you know what I mean? I want her to always have that dangerous edge, you know? One of the commercials said something about, I don't think we've seen this in the plot yet, but whose car is this? Or is this your car? And she says, no, it belongs to the man that I killed and stuffed in the trunk, or something like that, you know? So there should always be this shocking, cold element to her, and I feel like we've seen a little bit too much of her kind of likable side, if you will. I want to be reminded that she is an instrument of death, and I want Sarah and John to be a little bit more uncomfortable around her at times. I don't want them getting friendly and treating her like this pet or this dog, you know, that they can sick on people, you know. I think she should always be a little bit frightening. So hopefully we'll see them heading more and more in that direction. Okay, so let's talk about X-Men Origins Wolverine. That's the next movie coming out, starring Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. According to comics to film, the film is going to trace Wolverine's past as he discovers the world of mutants and the Weapon X program, which turns people into living weapons. Now, Hugh Jackman is, you know, kind of mums the detail on plot stuff, but he says it's hardly going to be a one mutant story. He says that Sabretooth, Wolverine's nemesis, is going to play a much bigger part, and there will be a good bit of cameos of new and familiar mutants. Hugh Jackman says, but you can't give too much away because fans are pretty hardcore. Their expectations go up a level every time you come out with a new film. Well, not for me this time, Mr. Jackman. After X-Men 3, my expectations are not particularly fantastic for another X-Men movie. I'm probably not alone in that, although I know some people really loved it, just loved all the action and stuff like that. I missed the characterization. But anyway, I'm just hoping that... oh, crap, I was going to look up his name, and I've totally forgot. But the actor that played Sabretooth in the first X-Men movie, he's like a pro wrestler in his background, and I'm just wondering if he's going to be playing Sabretooth in this prequel. He worked okay in the first one when Sabretooth was this kind of silent, brainless kind of, you know, non meaning Ursa, non and General Zod from the from Superman 2. you know, if he's playing this kind of non type character, this big brute that doesn't say anything and thinks even less, you know, then that actor was fine. But I'm not sure that he could pull off, you know, something that's more complex, which I don't know much about the comic book Sabretooth, but my understanding is he's not this silent, brainless brute as he was somewhat depicted in the first X-Men movie. So I'm wondering if they'll need to get a new actor to play him. I wouldn't mind the change-up. I mean, they certainly change things up with... oh, gosh, who was the Kitty Pryde in the X-Men movies? Didn't we see three different Kitty Prydes in all three movies? So I think changing Sabretooth wouldn't be that big of a deal, and might be a good move. We'll see. Okay, based on a display at WonderCon, Comics to Film reports that fans who don't like the Hulk portrayed as a giant in the movies, as he was in the last live-action movie, will be disappointed. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's great to portray the Hulk as a giant. I didn't have a problem with the first movie as much as everybody else seemed to. I did think it was slow at the beginning, but I thought the portrayal of the Hulk, once we got into it, was really cool. He was fast, he was furious, he was huge. You know, the more angry he got, the bigger he got, which is the concept straight from the comic books, if I'm not mistaken. He was a force of nature, and that worked so well, and people expecting the lumbering Lou Ferrigno, I hope, will continue to be disappointed. Even though I've heard that this second movie is going to take more inspiration from the TV series, I'm glad that the Hulk is going to be this giant instead of doing a slow-motion bodybuilder kind of thing. Let's see here. Comics to Film also reports that Kurt Sutter, who is the screenwriter for Punisher Warzone, Kurt Sutter says he's filed a motion with the WGA to have his name removed from consideration for credit for the Punisher Warzone script. Sutter says, I changed the locations, the characters, the story. I dropped Frank in a real New York City with real villains, real cops, real relationships. To me, the Punisher deserved more than the usual comic book redress. It shouldn't just follow the feature superhero formula. So what does he mean by feature superhero formula? Well, he goes on to say, the final script, rewritten almost completely by Holloway and Markham, was the perfect comic book formula. Simple story, very obvious dialogue, and the inclusion of as many characters from the anthology that a movie will allow. This is not a spoiler. All the characters were announced when they began shooting. I'm sure true fans of the Punisher comic books will enjoy this movie. It will do exactly what a comic book movie should do: fill seats, set up a sequel. This isn't sour grapes. Writing those superhero movies is a definite skill set. Not many people do it well, but it's just not something I find all that compelling. So we'll see what kind of movie Punisher Warzone turns out to be. I like the first one okay. It wasn't mind-blowing. I think fans of Punisher were bummed out by it because it wasn't all they hoped it would be. I can see that. It didn't have as much action as some might like. I didn't think that Frank Castle, from what little I know about the Punisher, I didn't think that he was angry enough, you know. He, like, the whole popsicle routine, torturing the guy with the popsicle, it seemed a little bit light for me. I almost expected Frank Castle to actually be burning him in the back and really messing with him, but that would have been a really dark movie. And so I don't know what they were thinking with the first one. It was an okay movie, but I'm not as distraught as fans are, I'm sure. So hopefully the second one will be better, but you know, I'm not sure that I want it to be totally realistic and not have all, you know, references to the comic book. I think you should, in comic book movies, they should really respect the source material. But I also don't think that you should forget about characterization and going for realism, you know. So, you know, we'll see what the movie ends up being when that comes out. Okay, Empire Magazine talked to Shia LaBeouf about Transformers 2. And LaBeouf says, the previses that I've seen, it's just massive. It's the first, if the first one was any indicator of how massive can be, this is going to blow that out of the water. It's insane. Mike's mind, and he's referring to Michael Bay, Mike's mind was just kind of made for this. It's amazing. There's going to be a lot more characterization with the robots, which I'm excited about. You know, I'm excited about any kind of characterization. You know, preferably realistic characterization. I thought the first Terminator blew massive chunks. It was, you know, it was a Michael Bay movie. So, I mean, I went in even with the expectation that, okay, this is a Michael Bay movie. But it, just the adolescent humor was, you know, it didn't do anything for me. You can go back and find that podcast that I did on my review of Transformers and get my full opinion on that. But suffice it to say that I, too, would love more characterization of any kind in Transformers 2. We'll see. I don't think bigger is better. I think we saw plenty big in the first one. I would just prefer better over bigger. All right, Captain Atom. This is not news so much as it is me just kind of sounding off and wondering what the heck is going on with Captain Atom in DC Comics. If you're following his storyline in 52 or Countdown, first of all, some background. There's a character called Monarch that's appeared in the DC Comics right now in Countdown in 52. He first kind of made his appearance in terms of costume, this version of Monarch anyway, at the end of the Battle for Bloodhaven miniseries a year or two ago. But anyway, the original concept for Monarch was that he was a superhero gone bad. And there was a storyline in the 90s, early 90s, called Armageddon 2001. And in that storyline, which carried over the series of all the DC Comics annuals that summer, Captain Atom was supposed to be revealed as this hero that had gone bad, that wanted to make the world right according to his vision of how the world should be. And so he put on this cool-looking armor, which I still think is really cool, and try to take over the world, you know. But the information leaked, and there wasn't even, you know, really the internet back then like it exists today. But so it was unheard of for stuff like this to leak, but it leaked. And so at the last minute, they changed the hero that went bad to Hawk, as in Hawk and Dove. And Captain Atom was kept around. But anyway, now they're making an effort to kind of make Nathaniel Atom, Captain Atom, into Monarch as he was always meant to be. And so they're reworking the plot to put him inexorably into the armor of Monarch, since the old Monarch is gone, and, you know, there's some continuity mix-ups with Monarch, but anyway, suffice it to say, the old Monarch is out of the picture. It started out with Monarch going to the Wildstorm universe, which is a DC spin-off universe that's a separate continuity, but the superheroes there are much more like, I've lost my words, but you know what I was trying to say. They've basically taken over the government, not officially, but with their threats and their brute and all their, you know, strength and stuff like that. The government is afraid of them, and so that's the kind of world that Captain Atom was in, and he saw the heroes there completely out of control. And when he came back finally to the DC universe, he kind of wanted to prevent that from happening in the DC universe, and so but it's weird. His armor was ruptured, and so he was going to explode, and so these scientists or whatever, put him inside of the Monarch armor, which they just happened to find, or they made it, and it just fate determined that it would be made to look exactly like the Monarch armor we've seen in the past. But anyway, he's now kind of taken on the role of Monarch, and now he's gathering all these heroes and villains from various multiple universes to basically take control or whatever. So, but the problem I'm having is that as soon as he put on the Monarch armor, just a couple issues later when he appeared in another comic book, he started talking like this typical, stereotypical villain, you know, which he just didn't sound at all like Captain Atom in the way that he was written. So I've been trying to figure out, you know, okay, how are they justifying what's going on, you know, with him turning into this, you know, egomaniacal kind of villain, you know, ooh, yes, my dear, they shall perish, you know, and saying weird, stupid crap like that that Captain Atom never said, you know. So I went to the DC message boards to kind of see what other people were thinking about this, the basic explanations given there were that the armor is connected to his brain and may be manipulating him somehow, and I will give them that because they did say when he first appeared at the end of Battle for Bloodhaven that the armor was connected to his brain, but they didn't say that it was manipulating him, I don't think. Let's see here. Before acting like a stereotypical villain, he also spent some time in the Bleed, which is this kind of dimension between dimensions, like a gateway dimension, which, according to one fan on the message boards of DC Comics, causes mutation and insanity if someone's exposed to it for a prolonged period, which, you know, Captain Atom as Monarch may have been. I don't know much about the Bleed. It's a concept from the Wildstorm universe primarily, but it's kind of entering the mainstream now with what's going on with Countdown and all the 52 multiple universes. So, you know, while all these little details fill in the loopholes decently, it should have been expressed in the story. I'm still waiting for the comics to deal with his character transformation more fully and more realistically and more respectfully to the history of Captain Atom. I'm not even a huge Captain Atom fan. I just think right now it looks like bad writing. I don't mind Captain Atom going bad and turning into Monarch, but explain it to me. Give me a reason. Help me suspend my disbelief a little bit more. So anyway, lastly, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe is coming out on DVD this Tuesday. I am definitely going to be grabbing my copy as soon as possible on that day. It was a great animated series. I'll probably do a review for it next week, but suffice it to say, you should at least consider renting it if it's available for a rental. Even if you weren't a fan of the He-Man toys and cartoons. Like, I didn't collect the He-Man, the original animated series, which has been coming out. I think it's all released now on DVD. I didn't collect that because, you know, it doesn't interest me that much. But when I saw this version of He-Man air on Cartoon Network just a couple years ago, or actually it was 2002, so it was more than a couple years ago, it was a perfect blend of sci-fi and fantasy. It was just such a great, and the animation was fantastic. It was really handled very well. So I would highly recommend checking it out. I'll probably give a review either at patersbrain.blogspot.com this week or on the podcast next week. So watch those two spaces if you want more info on the DVD release. That's it for our main feature.
Every word of God proves true. The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of our God stands forever.
All right, today we're searching for truth in the book of Acts chapter 12, and this is just going to be part one of our look at chapter 12 because we've got an opportunity for, I think, a fun sidetrack, and that's caused us to space this chapter out just a little bit. Okay, so starting off looking at this chapter, King Herod Agrippa I, he's the nephew of the Herod that tried Jesus and put John the Baptist to death, so it's a different Herod, but he began persecuting Christians at this point. He was part Jewish himself and seems to have been doing this possibly to gain favor with the Jewish people that he ruled over. Capturing Peter, he held off on a public trial until the Passover week, also called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He wanted to wait till that was finished, because that would mean that, that would mean that more Jews would be able to witness the trial, since they would be finished with their religious festival. So if he was trying to impress the Jews, that would be a great strategy to get them to the trial. Peter was locked in chains and watched by four squads made up of four soldiers each, a large group of soldiers that took their responsibilities very seriously. They probably knew and feared the consequences for failing in their task, which those consequences they had to face in verse 19 of chapter 12, if you take a look at that. Just another shout out there, just a reminder, we would love it if you would read through these chapters before we go through them, because otherwise you're just listening to a dude just talking about, you know, his observations, and even though I do my best to study and really get to the truth of the matter and what's going on here, what's expressed, I am not the Word of God. I am not even close to any kind of replacement for that. So I really hope you're going on this journey and reading through these chapters with us. Moving on. Okay, God still had work left for Peter. He wasn't going to leave him rotting in the cell. The night before his scheduled trial, an angel came and freed Peter from his chains. And together, Peter and the angel walked right past the guards and watched the gate to the city just open for them all by itself. It wasn't until the angel vanished and Peter was in the city that he realized he hadn't been seeing things. I mean, he thought he was just kind of having this psychedelic dream, you know. But then when the angel was gone and he was out in the city, he realized, holy crap, this is all really happening. Now, Peter wasn't the only one who had trouble believing in what had happened. When he came to the place where his friends were praying for him, he knocked on the door and, you know, hey, Peter here, you know, and they didn't believe that the servant girl said that, you know, heard Peter at the door. She came and said, Peter's at the door, you know, and they didn't believe her. She didn't even open the door. She just heard him knock or say something outside and came and reported. Now, I want to take a little bit of time here. This is the sidetrack I was talking about. I want to take a little time here and talk about angels. As I was looking at this, there are several different ways that historians and scholars interpret verse 15. If you look at verse 15, I believe this is the NIV that I've printed out here. It says, "You're out of your mind," they told her, Peter's friends that were praying in the house. When she kept insisting that it was so, in other words, that Peter was outside the door, they said it must be his angel. Now, Craig S. Keener in the IVP Bible Background Commentary, IVP being University Press, a respected source of just Christian scholarly knowledge. There goes my words right out the window, which makes it sound like they're a really reputable group of people. But anyway, don't listen to my bad description of them. They're well respected in Christian circles. In his IVP Bible Background Commentary, he says, in some popular Jewish traditions, the righteous would become like angels after death. Matthew Henry, a well-known theologian from several hundred years ago, also acknowledges that the disciples here may have been superstitious and believed this person at the door to be a supernatural omen of Peter's death. Now, another theory is that Peter was believed to be a human messenger representing Peter, since the Greek word angelos is used interchangeably for human messengers in the New Testament. You can see examples of that word being used for clearly human messengers in Luke 7:24 and Luke 9:52. So since it's also used interchangeably for human messengers, it's possible that the disciples thought the servant girl only heard someone say Peter's name at the door. So in other words, they were saying something to the effect of, it must be a messenger, it must be his messenger, you know. Let's see here. Finally, some believe that this verse and Matthew 18:10 suggest the idea, and you have to look at 18:10 to see the connection here, suggest the idea of guardian angels who are closely bonded to the individual humans that they serve, thereby taking on traits, like Peter's voice would be in this case, of those they protect. Now, the first two options seem the most credible to us, that either they were superstitious and thought it was like an omen or a ghost or something like that, or that they thought it was a messenger, a human messenger representing Peter. Although the word angelos doesn't seem to lend itself to mean ghost or something similar in the Greek lexicons that I've examined, I think it'd be very possible for the disciples, through lack of understanding and superstition, because the church was very young still, to believe that dead people can potentially become like angels in some way. And we've certainly seen that concept evolve and be seen in classic cartoons and stuff like that. I want to make it clear that's an unbiblical concept. That's something that we've just kind of somewhere along the way created this image of when people die, they grow wings and get harps and they become angels and stuff like that. But nowhere in the Bible does it indicate that we will become angels. The closest would be, I'm trying to think of the reference right now, but Paul's talking about how we will become like angels, but he's just talking about something we'll have in common with angels, not that we will become in appearance, in function, and stuff like that, like angels. Let's see here. Whatever the case may be here, it was an unbelievable night. Oh, yeah, I want to, one more possibility. The possibility of guardian angels. I want to be careful to not come to the conclusions described about guardian angels based on so few verses with so little detail. So I think that, like, you know, if you look at Matthew 18 and then you look at this section of scripture here, you can look at the possibility that there are angels that are assigned to us and to, you know, to individually guard us and are some way closely attached to us. Sure, that's a possibility. But that's kind of, for me, that's in the realm of speculation. It makes for good sci-fi stories, good fantasy stories, you know, to speculate on that kind of stuff. But to actually kind of make that a part of my personal doctrine or something that I'm really going to put a lot of weight on and depend on in my day-to-day life, I'm not going to do that, I don't think, because there's just so little detail and so few verses to base that idea on that I'm aware of. If you know some more that really support the kind of closely bonded guardian angel to human relationship, I'd be interested in checking them out. Whatever the case may be here, though, like I said, this was an incredible night. God displayed his power in an astonishing way. So we're going to see the rest of this chapter next week. Next week, we're going to look at pride and politics. If you are seeing some of that in the political races right now, then that might have some extra appeal to you. But we're going to look at pride and politics a little bit next week in the rest of chapter 12. The coffeehouse question this week: what thoughts or images come to mind when you think of the word angel? Like I said, we've got those pop culture images of wings and harps and stuff like that, but maybe some other images come to mind, or some other concepts, character traits or physical traits or powers that angels have, whatever. I don't care what it is. I want to know what comes to mind when you think of the word angel. You can give me a response to that, or as always, any other aspect of the podcast you want to talk about, you know, whether you like it or hate it, at patersbrain.blogspot.com. You can use the microphone on your computer and click on the recorder at the bottom of that screen to leave me a message. You can do the same thing at pater.libsyn.com. There's a little one-click recorder there if you've got a mic on your computer. Otherwise, you can send me an email at pater@spiritblade.net. P-A-E-T-E-R is how you spell my name. pater@spiritblade.net. Okay, that about wraps it up for this week. I got an email and a comment post from Alan White. I'm going to read just some fractions of. He says, I've been listening to your Spirit Blade Underground podcasts. I caught the last three, and I'm going to make this a regular listen. When I first browsed the Spirit Blade site months ago, I was fascinated by your background and still very much am. Thanks for giving such a truthful representation of the Christian geek. Well, thank you big time, Alan, for checking us out and making us a regular listen. I hope it's something that you continue to check out and enjoy. I personally don't think my background is all that fascinating. I think I've got a pretty boring life. But I do have this strange, weird fantasy that one day they'll make a poorly produced, badly acted, and terribly written TV movie about my life in which I play myself and do a terrible job. Especially since I would want to play myself like in junior high and high school too. That'd be a little awkward, but it's this creepy little fantasy that I have, so... Anyway, let's see here. And as far as a truthful representation of the Christian geek, I hope so. I hope that one thing that people feel and know when they listen to the Spirit Blade Underground podcast is that Christians can be geeks, that we can totally dig weird sci-fi and fantasy and even horror, and not be departing from the scriptural mandates and directions and principles for our lives. I think we have to use discernment, and I think we have to put our brains on and think. But I think that Christians can absolutely be geeks and geek out over weird, creepy, wild, sci-fi, imaginative, crazy stuff. I hope I can continue to encourage people in that way, because that's what I want to do. And then he also posted on my the podcast site. And he had, initially he had trouble, and I think this is the comment that finally came through, because I had to release like the limitation that I would have to approve comments. So now if you want to comment, you shouldn't need approval. It should immediately be published. But anyway, he says in response to my wife's coupon for Valentine's chocolates: when the wife gives you a coupon to the gift she wants you to get her, I call that idiot-proofing the holiday, he says with a smile at the end. Sweet! I absolutely agree. I was not going to pass that up. Hello. That makes one more task this year much, much easier. So hopefully... hopefully she'll continue to do that, because I just think that's great. I think that's great when women communicate. Isn't that wonderful? You know, when they tell you what's on your mind. You know, some people, you know, actually, you know, the stereotype is that women like blah, 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 you know. But for me, I'm the, that's my job in our relationship, my, with me and my wife. And she's the one that kind of like keeps things under wraps, and I kind of have to coax it out of her and stuff like that. So anytime I get a direct, bold direction from her, it's fantastic. Anyway, that's it. I'm going to get ready this afternoon to game master my DC Heroes RPG group that's coming over tonight. They have no idea what's in store for them. It's going to be really cool. But anyway, if you're not part of a gaming group and you feel like listening and reading in on the stupid, self-absorbed accounts of our game sessions, I do post them at patersbrain.blogspot.com as little issues that are summaries of our game sessions. But that's only if you're really a geek and you have absolutely nothing better to do. I mostly put that on there for my gaming group, not because I think anybody else would particularly enjoy it. But if you want to just see what's going on, you're welcome to be part of our little geek world in that way. Anyway, I hope you have a great week. I hope you come back and listen to us next week. And until then, I hope in all things you seek the truth.
Is awesome. Vader is a crazy freak.